KQED.
Digital Foundry Business and Software Consulting is proud to support its multinational clientele and the California Report podcast, Digital Foundry, on the web at digitalfoundry.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, golden moments in the Golden State, historic turning points for California, and none was bigger than California's reaction to World War II.
During the Second World War, Californians mastered the social, the economic, the industrial, the engineering tools and techniques to recreate California in the post-war period as a global megastate.
Also, 50th birthdays for the Monterey Jazz Festival and the L.A. Dodgers, and a living history of the gold rush.
As long as you don't run through the streets screaming gold again.
Well, there are great wonders here in California to be promoted. Gold is one among many of them.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. California has a colorful history with a can-do spirit dating back to the gold rush, but the present, well, there are signs we've lost a little of that bounce in our step, at least for a while. It comes by way of a new survey from the Public Policy Institute of California, and it finds state residents with strikingly high levels of pessimism about our economic future. In fact, 59% of residents expect bad economic times in the next year. Mark Baldessari directed the survey, and he says it isn't just the middle class that's feeling jittery about its financial future.
What was unique about this particular survey to me is that it was really across the board. Usually you're seeing lower income people reacting to economic events more quickly and more negatively than upper income people. But in this particular survey, we saw homeowners and renters, people with incomes over 80,000, people with incomes under 40,000, all reacting very negatively, and that suggests that the turmoil that's affecting the stock markets and the mortgage market are really affecting a broad spectrum of Californians.
What about regional differences?
We're seeing across the regions of California right now a negative outlook, but interestingly, it's those areas of California where the housing downturn has hit the hardest. Orange, San Diego, the Inland Empire, the Central Valley, those areas that have experienced a tremendous boom and appreciation are the ones now that people are feeling most vulnerable.
In terms of issues, immigration and health care are the top two concerns that people, Californians, say that they have. Mm-hmm. Health care is the one area where there's a lot of discussion now mm-hmm. about doing something big mm-hmm. in California. The governor and Fabian Nunez, the speaker mm-hmm. of the assembly, really trying to push something through up yeah. in Sacramento. What impact would success mm-hmm. in that regard have on people's moods and their attitudes toward mm-hmm. government?
Success on health care reform would be huge. It would be a huge boost in terms of people's sense that, government can act, can do things on issues that are of importance. Consider the fact that 7 in 10 Californians are saying we need major changes in our health care system, and that majority of voters right now are closely watching what the governor and legislature are doing in the area of health care reform.
California has always been known or thought of mm-hmm. as this kind of land of milk and honey, this mm-hmm. place of opportunity. Mm-hmm. Do Californians still feel that it's that kind of place?
Yeah, I think that when you ask Californians, are they living in the best place they could in the United States, and how do they feel about, you know, the quality of life here, we still see that this is viewed as a land of opportunity. What's changed from after World War II was this was viewed by people coming from other states as the land of opportunity. And what we've seen since is that the image of California as the promised land, so to speak, is worldwide now. And those who arrive here from other shores are the most appreciative of what California has to offer. And maybe they have the most perspective, and they're the ones who are most optimistic about what the future holds.
Mark Baldessari, pollster and president and CEO of the Public Policy Institute of California, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You'll find plenty of that gloomy outlook Mark Baldessari described in the Los Angeles Dodgers dugout. After a great start, the team is close to being eliminated from the playoffs. So you can hardly blame the Dodgers for looking ahead to next year when the team marks the 50th anniversary of its arrival in California. Team officials recently brought a few old-timers to Dodger Stadium to get things started. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Frank Stoltz reports.
50 years ago, Don Newcomb was a starting pitcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers when rumors started flying.
We started hearing whispers about it around the clubhouse, and then finally Mr. O'Malley came in and told us what he was going to do. And a lot of guys didn't want to come to California. Gil Hodges and some of them didn't want to leave their families. Their families didn't want to move.
Nuke, as Newcomb was known, wasn't one of them.
I wanted to move. I needed to move because I was in the midst of a divorce. I lived in New Jersey, and I wanted to get to California to get away from that alimony payments.
The Dodgers arrived in Los Angeles in 1958 and played their first local games at the Coliseum. Dodger Stadium opened in 1962. Back then, Tommy Lasorda was already something of a Dodger veteran. He had pitched for them for 2 years in Brooklyn, left the team, then came back as a scout. Lasorda was third base coach when he succeeded famed manager Walter Alston in 1976.
I was hoping that one day I could manage the Dodgers. I was hoping that one day my contribution, my loyalty, and my knowledge would warrant me that job. I turned down a lot of other jobs, and finally the day came.
What was the biggest contribution you think you made to the Dodgers?
I just made players better than they were. I love to motivate players, and I felt that wherever they went, there was a little bit of me walking with them.
You got a favorite player?
Can't say.
No good coach from Little League on up answers that question. Dodgers officials say they'll honor players from throughout their Los Angeles history during their golden anniversary next year. Among them is Steve Yeager, who played catcher for the team from 1972 until 1975. He's also coached for the team.
Some of these kids just don't get it.
What don't they get?
They don't get what it means to be a Dodger. It's a certain, not a cockiness, but it's a certain air that you walk around knowing that you're going to beat somebody up. You're going to go out and play as hard as you can play. And if you don't beat yourself and the opposition beats you, you tip your cap and you come back the next day.
Sweet Lou Johnson nodded his head in agreement. The left fielder started his career in the Negro Leagues and ended up with the Dodgers in 1965. He remembered the racial climate back then.
Our safe haven was the dressing room. We all lived together.
That's our home
like place. Brothers and sisters. I never had a fight because of black and white in our dressing room. It was always the outsiders, the newspapers, the media, and so forth.
There'll be a lot of reminiscing during the next year. For Johnson, that means remembering two hits 42 years ago.
The perfect game, the Koufax pitch, I got the only hit and only run. And then in the World Series, the seventh game, I got the home run to win the championship. So, you know, those two things you never forget. And if I'm to be remembered for two hits, I'd take it all the way to the bank, baby.
The Dodgers' golden anniversary means plenty of promotional opportunities for the team and its sponsors, too. There'll be a Dodgers float in the Rose Parade for the first time. The team will become the first sports organization to score a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. There'll be lots of fan participation, too. Already, fans can vote online for the top 50 moments in Dodger history and for their all-time team. Stay tuned for the results next year. For the California Report, I'm Frank Stoltz in Los Angeles.
Another golden anniversary is already upon us. This weekend marks the 50th season of the Monterey Jazz Festival, the bold new musical experiment launched on the West Coast in 1958. Andrew Gilbert reviews a treasure trove of new CDs culled from the festival's archives.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, just the greatest, the king, Louis Armstrong, Satchmo.
Dizzy Gillespie had no way of knowing it at the time, but when he introduced jazz patriarch Louis Armstrong at the first Monterey Jazz Festival in 1958, it was the start of a beautiful relationship. Jazz has found a home in Monterey ever since. The moment is captured on one of five CDs from the newly minted Monterey Jazz Festival Records label, each one featuring a jazz legend recorded live at the fairgrounds. Their release is part of the festival's 50th season.
Now the pale moon shining on the fields below. Now folks are crooning south below.
The 1958 set by Satchmo is typical of his All-Stars. Still, it's great to hear the music's most beloved international ambassador playing for an adoring audience.
Yes, the soft wind blowing.
More than anyone, Dizzy Gillespie came to represent the festival's good time spirit, a vibe that welcomed both serious music and hipster hijinks. The modern jazz genius performed at Monterey so often, you never knew where he was going to show up or what he might do on stage. The mock calypso, Poor Joe, and a comedy sketch is followed by a blazing version of his standard A Night in Tunisia. It's vintage Dizzy, making you laugh one moment and gasp at his virtuosity the next. Gillespie was a king wherever he roamed, but Monterey was truly his realm. That was the idea when disc jockey Jimmy Lyons and San Francisco Chronicle columnist Ralph Gleason set out to create a West Coast counterpart to the Newport Jazz Festival. Monterey was part of a movement determined to take jazz musicians out of smoky, clattering nightclubs to present them as creative figures worthy of close attention. Trumpeter Miles Davis is captured in 1963 in prime form, making his West Coast debut with his quintet, featuring an awesome 17-year-old drummer named Tony Williams. Thelonious Monk made his second festival appearance in 1964. Only months after he'd been featured on the cover of Time magazine, he sounds totally at ease, stretching out with a quartet on a program of his ingenious compositions. For the last two numbers, his band is joined by five horns, an unusual nine-piece setting for Monk, who seems to relish Buddy Collette's arrangement of Straight No Chaser. While the Monk Big Band tracks are a rarity, most of the Monterey albums add to already well-documented periods of the artist's careers. That's one reason why my favorite release of the set is the session by Sarah Vaughan, who hadn't made a studio album in almost 5 years when she appeared at Monterey in 1971. A festival regular, Sassy sounds positively glorious. Her deep, velvety voice had no problem filling up the spacious outdoor arena. One highlight is her sizzling version of The Lamp Is Low. While you linger in my arms, my lips will say I love you so. Dream the sweetest dreams you'll ever know. Tonight the moon is high, the lamp is low. With these releases, Monterey is building on its storied history. For its 50th year, the festival has assembled a talent-laden program. Amazingly, half a dozen musicians who performed at the first festival are returning for the golden anniversary, including guitarist Jim Hall, tenor sax titan Sonny Rollins, and pianist-composer Dave Brubeck, the Concord native whose status as a festival favorite remains undiminished at 86. Over the decades, Monterey has survived and thrived by tending its ties to the music's greatest figures, while helping nurture the next generation of improvisers. The five albums from the archives and an all-star tour led by pianist Benny Green will help spread the Monterey name. But it's the festival experience, where fans and players rub shoulders on the fairgrounds, that continues to make Monterey one of jazz's signature events.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed new CDs featuring sets from Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, Thelonious Monk, Sarah Vaughan, and Miles Davis, all live at the Monterey Jazz Festival. You're listening to the California Report. This weekend, a much-anticipated Ken Burns documentary about World War II begins airing on public television stations across the country. KCET in Los Angeles produced a companion program called California at War. It shows how the state was transformed during the 1940s. Here's a clip from the film where state historian Kevin Starr describes the essential contribution California made to the war effort.
It is difficult to imagine the United States prevailing in the Second World War without the ships made in California, without the airplanes manufactured in California, without the troops being trained in California, and without Californians fighting and dying on distant fields of battle.
Brett Marcus is executive producer of California at War.
I think California was changed by the war, and California also did change the war in terms of it becoming a major production center, with aircraft building in the southern part of the state and shipbuilding in the northern part of the state. And as Kevin Starr says, you know, there are many who would agree with him that the war might not have been won without the participation of California.
And people began flowing into California, either enlisted people who were setting sail for the Pacific Theater, people who were coming to work here, and so on. Describe how California became kind of a place of opportunity for people, both those who were here and those who came here, you know, before, during, and after the war.
Well, I think there were jobs in the defense industry, and you were coming out of the Depression, and you had thousands of Okies from the Midwest who were looking for jobs, and they came west. You had hundreds of thousands of African Americans from places like Texas, Louisiana, and Florida who were looking for work. The Bracero program brought lots of Mexican-Americans here who were needed to harvest crops. So there were real opportunities. It was very much a double-edged sword. There were great opportunities for non-whites in California during World War II. At the same time, you know, that discrimination didn't go away.
The role of Mexican-Americans is also documented in the film, both as enlistees and the sacrifices they made in various ways. And there is, of course, the episode involving the Zoot Suiters, and I want to play a clip from the film. But tell us who the Zoot Suiters were, for those who may not remember.
The Zoot Suiters were young Hispanic men, in some cases women, who dressed by the standards of the day somewhat flamboyantly. And you have, you know, soldiers who had literally just gotten off the farm in the Midwest coming here and for the first time in their lives seeing completely different cultures and different types of people. Probably the most jarring group to them were these sort of flamboyant young Mexican-Americans.
And there was an incident that that lasted 10 days or so, I believe, in 1943, where the Zoot Suiters got into a scuffle over a period of days with enlisted people. Let's listen to this clip from the film California at War, where we hear some Latino Army vets describing what happened.
A buddy of mine and I were downtown L.A., and three sailors came down there to beat us up. They didn't do too well, but then three more joined in, and we ran like rabbits.
The Marines got in, the police got in, then everybody was against the Zoot Suiters.
They used to tear our clothes and, you know, burn our clothes and all that, so it was rough, it was rough.
Brett Marcus, what is it that finally brought an end to the Zoot Suit incident? And they call it the riots, by the way, but it's not really clear that the Zoot Suiters were rioting. They were really being attacked.
They were frequently the victims. What finally brought it to an end, at least according to some of the people we spoke with, was that here the United States was trying to rid the world of fascism and tyranny, and yet all over Asia, the Zoot Suit Riots were being reported as, you know, American sailors and soldiers, you know, attacking non-whites in some of America's largest cities. And it was such bad publicity, and it got so out of hand.
One of the other aspects that's brought out in the program is the role that scientists played in the Manhattan Project, which, of course, has its legacy today at UC Berkeley and so on. Let's listen to a clip here from a scientist, Herb York, who was brought to California to work on this project.
California was the single most important center for the activity that led to the bomb. And although a bomb could have been built without California, if the United States ended at Nevada, still could have been done, but it would have taken much longer.
Brett Marcus, how difficult was it to get at this part of California's history during the war? Because, of course, it was top secret. Most of that is probably declassified now. But how easy was it to find people who were willing to talk about it?
It was difficult in some cases, but you know, we spent a few months on this, and we found the people, and much to my delight, we found some incredible footage of this and lots of other things. Some of the footage I don't think the public has ever seen. On VJ Day in San Francisco and Los Angeles with, you know, parades and sailors and soldiers. And you always see that footage from Times Square, but you rarely see it from California.
The documentary is called California at War. Brett Marcus is its executive producer. It's airing throughout the state, and you can check your local listings for times near you. Brett, thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You can't separate modern California's image as a land of opportunity from its roots in the Gold Rush. An event in Marin County this weekend called The Ghosts of Alampali will recreate that era, and the rule is that everyone who goes has to be dressed in period clothing. It's being held in what remains of Rancho Alampali, now a state park. In this sound portrait, producer Seal Muller discovers a gathering of some of California's most notorious characters.
Okay, since this is an all-will-be-costumed event, the first thing I have to do is get into my outfit. It's a lovely burgundy-colored billowy skirt with a fetching white blouse. And now off I go through a time portal to join the ghosts who populate Alampali State Historic Park. Here, time stands firmly in the 19th century. The summer brown hills shaded by stately live oak trees and scattered around the few whitewashed remains of adobe structures. A horse-drawn surrey rolls by and, why look, here's Mark Twain.
Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Twain.
I'm just out here looking for anything that might be news. You know, summer is always a kind of a dead season. The news gets kind of shy, you know, when it gets too hot or too cold, which it always is both in San Francisco.
As I start to stroll through the grounds, I continue to come upon the people who bring to life the authenticity of the clothing, jargon, and music of the era.
Oh, where did you get that hat? Where did you get that tile? Isn't it a nubby one in just the proper style? I should like to have one just the same as that. Wherever I go, they shout, hello, where did you get that hat?
Hello, sir, and you are?
Norton One, ma'am. Emperor of California, protector of Mexico and the United States.
And how do you think your legacy might live on?
I hope that it would live on in a legacy of peace. Having seen the carnage of our late conflict between the North and the South, I called upon the nation to heal its wounds and to become a greater whole.
And there's lots of talk about Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to run for president in the U.S.
She is a supporter of all women's rights, and indeed, I believe she is for suffragette and for property rights, and she, although she does believe in free love, which I can't get
behind that. I don't know about
that.
How does she give women the vote? It's time for women to vote.
Indeed. We need our rights.
You want to vote, don't you, miss?
Well, actually, I'm from the state of Wyoming, and women can vote in Wyoming.
Hallelujah. You let you go to Wyoming? Hallelujah.
Boston shall be in Frisco, and they're all of the round. See the gold ups there, I'll pick them off the ground.
I'll scrape those
those rivers dry.
As long as you don't run through the streets screaming gold again.
Well, there are great wonders here in California to be promoted. Gold is one among many of them.
And Sam Brannan is looking very dapper today. It was Brannan who, upon learning of the find at Sutter Mill, ran through the streets of San Francisco shouting gold in the American River. This was only after he bought up every pick and shovel in the area and set up shop, guaranteeing he'd become very rich.
Mr. Brannan, you do seem to have your hands in a lot of pies here.
Well, as a harvest celebration, I find that there are many entrepreneurial opportunities here on the new frontier. As I mentioned, there is gold in those hills, but there are also a need for tents and shovels, and I'm here to provide for those needs.
So you're a prospector?
I hope to be, ma'am.
Oh, I haven't gotten there yet.
No, I just got off the boat from Missouri. Went around the Horn and bought my gear here in San Francisco. And I heard tell that out Sacramento way, you could just kick the ground and gold pops right out of it. So got me about week's worth of provisions. I figure I'll be rich by then.
And your name?
Jeremiah Ezekiel Smith.
I wish Mr. Smith good luck on his search for the California dream and bid farewell to the 19th century. This is the final weekend of the year for Go Savo and Polly. It's still an evolving concept, and the creators intend to bring it to schools in 2008. Whether they return to Olam Polly State Park next summer or make it into a traveling show remains to be seen. For the California Report, I'm Seal Muller.
To see photos of some of the colorful characters Seal Muller met on her visit to Olam Polly, and to learn more about the event, check out our website. It's californiareport.org. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohn. Our interns are Deidre Crawford and Megan McCarty. The producer is Victoria Mullione. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, Osh Complete Home and Garden, offering service and selection to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.